All right, first things first, and I have to apologize for the talk this afternoon, because I allowed myself to get hastened myself, and I didn't hold things together as they should be held together. Yeah. All right, last evening in the first talk, we tried to learn where desire fits in the larger universe and in our inner constitution, what desire does. And we were maybe vaguely successful in that. Now, there were some places in that talk that could have led to misunderstandings. And the most likely place was that the presentation was almost like a dualism. One could have concluded that there was a spirit-matter dualism, and that would not have been exactly correct. It is true that abstract realms and states and concrete realms and states are very different from each other. So spirit and matter are very different from each other. But the reality is, as has been found out by all mystics, is that it is all one being. And that parts, or in one dimension or one direction would be a better way of saying it, in one direction it is more of the nature of spirit, and in another direction it is more in the nature of matter. So if we do pass from concrete experiences to transcendental experiences, it's shocking. So much so that most people can't even speak of the experiences of the transcendent because our language isn't anything like it. As different as it may be, and as eternal as it may be in juxtaposition to our sense of time in this world, those states are actually part of the same unity as this world. All right. Beside being differentiated into spirit and matter, there are all kinds of differentiations. And those differentiations are functional. We talked last evening about the different states of consciousness within our own being. In the Rosicrucian philosophy, those different differentiations of the one are called worlds. They could more accurately be called macrocosmic worlds, but when you start doing things like that, everything gets pretty wordy and tedious in a big hurry, so you just say words. Worlds. I have a preference. I use a word that is not used usually in Rosicrucian philosophy. I try to use the word world when I'm speaking about the stuff and its nature. When I'm referring to activity and the consciousness of activity, I use the word realm because I think that's a better usage of the English language. Some mystery schools use the word plane, but I don't like that usage at all because it connotes stratification and it ignores interpenetration, and one gets a very misguided view of what the cosmos is like. In reality, the further one goes in the direction of spirit, the broader unto boundlessness things are. And in that boundless broadness and the subtlety, all of those realms interpenetrate the material worlds where concentration is the order of the day and contraction, that those worlds are actually interpenetrated. There are, in the Rosicrucian philosophy, seven worlds, which are the field of our evolutionary creation. They are notably the world of God, in which only the pure spirit that is behind everything, not necessarily active in anything, resides. And there is the realm called Virgin Spirit, in from which all of the beings that are becoming or have been becoming derive from, and those which will be becoming. There's also the world of Divine Spirit, which we talked about, the world of Life Spirit, the world of thought, the desire world, and the physical world. Each of these worlds has a function, each of these worlds has a purpose in the general scheme of things, and that's what we tried to talk about yesterday. Each of these worlds has its own laws, its own principles, and its own way of doing things. But because the One is the One and is ultimately indifferentiable in final reality, a unity is maintained so that there are parallelisms between all of the different realms, so that things that occur on one realm will have ramifications in every other realm in some kind of analogous fashion, so that we have the principle of analogy, which is true to all spiritual schools. It is called the Hermetic Axiom. As above, so below. What has gone before in heaven will follow after on earth. Know this and rejoice. Now, the septenary differentiation of the One that is our field of creation can be seen analogously in each world, because each world has seven subdivisions. Now, there is a logical and a cosmological reason for the number seven. It isn't just a superstitious choice of words, but to go into that logical reason for the number seven would be way out of bounds, and we would then just talk all out of shape. In two of the worlds in which we are working in the evolutionary creation, the world of thought and the physical world, there are major subdivisions. For example, in the world of thought, the three highest regions in which one finds all of the ideas are called the region of abstract thought, and that is significantly different from the region of concrete thought. In the physical world, the four highest regions are called the etheric subdivision, and the three lowest, the solid, liquids, and gases, are called the chemical subdivision. Since we are focused in this chemical region of the physical world, we'll use that as a means to understand some of the principles from our own experiences and use those as springboards to the desire world. In this chemical region of the physical world are solids, liquids, and gases. We experience them every day. Part of the reason that we are here, to work within the limits of the solids, liquids, and gases, because learning in simplicity, when everything else is taken away and you only experience one thing, that is a great way to begin ABCDarian kind of experience. We are beginners and we are learning as beginners. However, as beautiful as this world is, we are so self-centered, and we're so personally preoccupied, that we often take interest in this world. It's a very, very sad thing. It's like friends. Sometimes take friends for granted. It hurts to be taken for granted. You care for someone, and when that person just doesn't even pay attention to you, especially if you have a committed relationship with someone, well, that's really very, very painful. Sometimes people need to be shocked out of it. I can still remember people back in in the 60s who had LSD experiences. And they would hold water in the palm of their hand, and being removed from their numbing in the physical body by being slightly withdrawn in the LSD experience, they understood the fluidity of water like they never had before. And it was like a miracle. In fact, they were so far removed that they weren't really too much capable of doing much in this physical world. Hopefully it helped them to realize that it's a wonderful thing. But by practicing observation, discrimination, and really living life to its fullest, that's what initiation is. Initiation is beginning or awakening to living life in its very, very fullest. We become alive in our consciousness, and everything Agurta is a perfectly good example of someone of initiate type of consciousness. He was interested in everything, and he was enthusiastically interested in everything. And he gave himself to all kinds of experiences, and through that, he certainly was probably in a much stronger state of consciousness than anyone in an LSD state. Physicists claim that a solid is any element or compound in a permanent crystalline structure. I'm one of those people that when people say, well, that's crystallized, I hate to hear it because that's the wrong word to use. The proper word to use is it's hardened. It crystallizes means a very highly organized state. For example, you take the blood in your veins and you put a drop of it out and let it dry and it crystallizes and it's beautiful, beautiful crystals. And they're unique crystals to each individual. Even in the course of your life, the organization of your blood changes so that the crystals vary. So anything that is a solid is a crystal. This means that it has been brought to a high state of perfection, usually by the gnomes and the other beings that are helping the life that is going through the mineral kingdom to perfect that experience. A liquid, or better said, a fluid, is something that doesn't have that structural organization. Fluid is either a liquid or a gas, and it is more amorphous. There are organizations, but it's a different kind of an organization. Some states are ambiguous. Glass, for example, is a supercooled liquid. It's hard, but it's not a crystal. It can be crystallized. No glass windows do not run. It would take many tens of thousands of years for a glass window to run, and what you're seeing is imperfections in the making of the glass when you see that. But another example is putty. Putty is a number of solids mixed together in such a way that it almost acts like a liquid. Now, some of the substances that we experience in all three states, like dihydrous oxide. We experience solidly as ice, liquidly as water, and gaseously as steam. So we recognize it's the same thing going through different states. All we have to do is apply enough heat to the ice until we reach the latent heat of fusion and it becomes a liquid, and then we keep adding heat. We come to the latent heat of vaporization. The heat itself is energy, and it comes from the etheric subdivision of the ethers. The way we work with the energies, because we're in a fallen state and we have a deathly kind of consciousness, we work with the energies only as they are decaying or as we're dying. Second law of thermodynamics says that all energy passes from a higher state to a lower state. And we deal with entropy, we deal with rotting energy. Can you imagine that? Rather than if we were really creative beings, we can deal like the plants do unconsciously and work with life and build forms creatively so that they would be able to live and contain their energy and not just break down. There are some things that are common to all four ethers. That is, there's a polarization. And there is a quality of withinness, which Max Heindel calls throughness, that with etheric vision, you not only see the surface, but you can see every layer all the way through an object. Some principles, some laws, are common to all seven of the regions of the physical world, and they are things like gravity, which is the most common example that is given. That's probably the most important. The differences between the etheric subdivision and the chemical subdivision of the physical world are great. It's almost disorienting, not quite, but almost disorienting to work with, for example, the healing energy. By the control of your consciousness, you magnetically are some on rare occasions allowed to handle the healing panacea. And it's like handling a magnetic gel of fluid gold. And it has miraculous abilities. And if anyone has that experience, it's something that they will not forget for a long, long time, probably never. Probably Aaliyah's teaching to be invisible helpers is probably one of the highest opportunities or privileges that we can have, because we have to be pure, we have to have control of ourselves, but the differences between the etheric subdivision and the chemical subdivision are nothing compared to the differences between the etheric world and the desire world. I mentioned it, I believe, last evening, that some desire world clairvoyants had actually even shut off the clairvoyance because it was too overwhelming to them. I have a friend that opened it up and couldn't shut it off, and seeing the difference between what somebody was doing and saying outwardly and what they were desiring inwardly, the hypocrisy was too much for that person to stand, and that person eventually pistol and blew her brains out because she couldn't stand all the hypocrisy, and she couldn't stand seeing the dweller on the threshold. A word to the wise, never try to force something with them. She was young on the spiritual path, and she forced something before she was ready for it, and then got herself into all kinds of trouble. Mr. Heindel tells us the same thing. He says that when somebody has been functioning as an unconscious invisible helper, most of us are functioning as unconscious helpers, and then only if we live lives that are harmonious with functioning as an invisible helper, and that person suddenly becomes a conscious invisible helper, whether they leave the body or whether they wake up on the other side, the experience is so disorienting. He says that a person that has been a very excellent invisible helper, it takes at least a half a year before they get their equipoise back that they can function as an invisible helper again. So it's something radically different. So radically different that much of what we know in the physical world does not apply at all to the desire. In fact, if you try to figure things out with the reference of this world, instead of just accepting what we're seeing and then letting the experience sink into us, if we try to hang on to our physical world interpretation of things, it can be an extreme drawback. to work differently. One example is time and space, which are the potential within which spiritual matter manifests. Here, we measure space extensively. We think of space as one room like this, and another one, extending out as far as things can go. That is not the way space is in the desire world. What in the desire world, what is dear to us, or what we take great interest in, is what is near to us. For example, if we were to look at our private rooms where we spend a lot of time by ourselves, if we were to look at all the items in that room from the desire world, they wouldn't be in the same position. The positions that they would be in whether they were important to us. Their size would depend on whether they were important to us. Yes, if we were focusing with both sensory perception of the physical world and the desire world, then the two worlds would be superimposed in the same area of space. But if we were looking just with desire vision, only the things that were important to us. The whole idea of space, the cosmic conception tells us, for example, when we are in the desire world, in what is called purgatory, our experience of desire isn't limited any longer to our physical vehicle. It goes to the extent of the desire world. And many people feel like they're pulled apart to all areas of space, and the areas that they are most pulled to are places in desire space where they had the most strong desire experiences while alive. See, we evaluate things in the physical world according to the principles of the physical world. And in the desire world, they don't work. In the desire world, we have to work by what is more important there. And in the desire world, the intensity of desire what is important. Our desires don't die just because we have attention to them. Things like desires actually live much, much longer. And that's even right in our own consciousness. Any psychiatrist who's worked with people to draw up things that are unresolved in the past and see how shocked people are when suddenly they call up an experience from the past and it is as alive now as it's ever been before. Because things are one step closer to the spirit and one step more eternal. And for that reason, things are very different. In the physical world, size, mass, density, and texture are important. Shapes and forms are important. They're important indicators of life. They indicate what kind of being is within. Obviously, you don't want to get a fist fight with a football player or something like that. You look at him, he flexes his muscles, and you know where that would go very quickly. But in the desire world, things are very different. In fact, a being can change its expression, its mien, and its size very quickly. Again, we have reports from Mr. Heindel and other clairvoyants telling us that when somebody's a neophyte, people with clairvoyance in many worlds, the entities love playing games with. Something will appear fearsome like a giant ogre or something like that, where if you stand your ground and hold your composure, it turns out to be just some little desire elemental that has no power at all. And so you have to have a different outlook. You have to be able to look through in the same way that we look through people who are slick salesmen and are trying to sell us something. we can eventually see through them and see that their motivation is sometimes a simple greed. The same thing is true in the desire world. We have to be able to see through the desire forms that are there to see what really is the nature of desire inside. So, in the desire world, when it is the lower desire world, and we call it purgatory, what we're actually doing is re-experiencing our desires in such a way that we neutralize them and dissolve them. Even though some of the most beautiful things in this world, such as music, or drama, or poetry, are very evanescent, the things of quality in performance are the most important. And those are echoes that come from the spiritual worlds. So we want to have tools that in this world, we want to have tools that are going to last and that are not going to break down. Even the things, the fairy tales that we thought to be worldly wise by are like a few little pigs. The pig that builds his house out of brick is the one that can withstand the wolf and is the hero of it. And it's very different in the desire world. Yes, there are moods and zeitgeists, spirits of the time, that change. Some of them last millennia. But there are many minute, very fast-changing desires. The whole purpose of the desire world, as we saw last night, is to motivate change. Because if there isn't any change, we don't experience reality fully. And the more we can experience and the more deeply we can experience it, the better we are doing in our evolution. Because each experience that we have sinks into our being and it awakens something in us. There's the example that if you walk in the forest, it's beautiful. But if you sit down in the forest and don't move, very soon the birds come flying back, the little squirrels that have been hiding in the trees, you see them right away because they start moving. When they were sitting still, you would never know them. But when there is change, when they start moving, immediately you know that they're there. So we have to have a different attitude in relation to desire. We have to let go of our desire for material permanence. That's one of our big drawbacks. A lot of times we come back to our body when we're out of it at night, and we come back with a thud because we cling to it with security. And, we have to let go of that if we really want to, we have to have faith. We have to adapt. We have to be able to believe in the spirit that is in us, that we can create good circumstances for ourselves, no matter what the conditions may be, no matter how much we change. Now, some of our feelings and emotions are faint. Usually the ones that are new are faint. And quite often, the lofty and rare emotions and feelings are faint. It doesn't have to be that way. Because artistic experience or altruistic experience can be every bit as intense as hatred or vengeance or something like that. In reality, since they involve soul power, the higher emotions should actually be more intense because they're more subtle. And the general principle that works through all of the worlds is that the more subtle something is, the more powerful something is. So even though we're talking about intense desires, we're not talking about, like fireworks displays of intensity. Because to recognize the truth of the desire world and to function in it, we have to become more and more subtle. We have to be able to be quiet, and we have to be able to make a distinction between this and that. And when we have that kind of poise that we can differentiate from one feeling from another, that's when we're on the verge of opening up clairvoyance. Subtlety means power, and the more subtle you can become, the better. But that doesn't mean that the higher desires, because they're subtle, are not strong. If you think about it, for me, the most intense and the strongest kind of feeling is probably very subtle. That is passion for Christ. If you look at all of the great spiritual leaders, Christ Jesus, most exceptionally, Buddha, and other great spiritual leaders, they, with their harmless, very subtle emotions, have had a greater effect on more people over a longer amount of time than any mafioso or anybody like that, because that shows the great power of something that is that subtle and that giving. In desire world, intensity is as important as size is in the material world. Right next door, for years, I was in lovely neighbors. There was a man and his wife who worked in a candy company that was about 4 blocks over, and she worked in a beauty salon. And they had a son and a daughter. And they had really, I really liked the people. He did all of his own stucco work on the house. He did most of his car work. He'd go to the library and check out a book and say, well, I figure somebody can put it together. I should take it to the car and fix it. And every night, the whole family would go down together. They would go down to the corner over here and go swimming together. And there was a captain in nature, and his name was Fred. Fred said to me once, he said, I figure if they grow up appreciating nature, they're not going to be too bad. You know, they have realistic views about things. The member of the family I want to get to is Shaggy. What was his name? I got it here down here somewhere. Pokey. He had like a little tiny dog. And Pokey was the guard of that house. He was a lap dog size. But in desire, he was very intense. On several occasions, I have seen him take on and chase away German shepherds. He was little like this, German shepherds. He'd just drive them off. And that was because he knew he was in the right, and he had that kind of intensity that he could, you know, animals still have a clairvoyant internal picture consciousness. And the pictures that he projected out to those dogs must have been some very fearsome kind of pictures. So intention and extension are not things of waxing and waning importance along the spirit-matter pole. Quantity and mass are important on one level, the quality and character are all important on a more high level, on the level of the desire world. In the physical world, if you need ballast, it doesn't matter whether you're using a stone as a ballast or whether you're using steel. What counts is the mass. And if you're in a boat that's in danger of sinking, from the physical world, not from the desire world, but from the physical world, if a radio weighs 40 pounds and a child weighs 40 pounds, as far as levitating that boat, throwing the child over is just equal to throwing the radio over. It's that kind of a situation. But in the desire world, it's very different. The desire world, the quality of emotion is all important. It's pretty obvious in some ways that if you want to have friends, if you're kind, if you're generous, if you're giving to them, those are quality emotions. You're sure to have friends. It doesn't make any difference whether you emote a lot. I don't even like to be around friends that emote too much. The quality of desire or emotion is felt. It's very important as far as the nature of the desire world is concerned. External shape in the desire world is important, not as important as what one feels. Even desire world clairvoyance is a matter of feeling. You don't look like you look with your physical eyes. You look with your ability to pick up and identify feelings. A desire world clairvoyant is someone who has opened an eye of feeling. And so when you hear all kinds of radical exercises about breathing or doing this or doing that, it isn't going to get you anywhere unless you develop your feelings so that you are sensitive and you can feel exactly what is what. Now, there are several things that are important in all of this. The desire world goes beyond the transitional realm of the ethers in that the desire world is inner. In fact, the more one goes into the level, into the direction of spirit on the spirit matter, the more the inner qualities are important. Until you get to the universal spirit, and everything is within the universal spirit, and it experiences everything in a withinness. Even what we would call the without is experienced totally within. This means that when we experience something in the desire world, with our desire world vision, we experience it inside of ourselves. And this means that there's a great possibility of misperception, that we're likely to subjectivity and illusion. There is an old saying that goes among clairvoyants of an old school, that one is always looking through one's own aura, because you're looking within your own emotional being. Just like we change the way the laws of physics work in our bodies by our consciousness. Similarly, we experience the desire world within our own being. Very hard to say it. So that even when you're seeing somebody with the desire world clairvoyance and you're looking with your physical eyes at the same time, you see someone out there with your physical eyes and there is an aura, but that aura is not in the same space as the physical is. The aura is in around there, but it is inward. And when you're experiencing it, you're experiencing inside yourself what is actually taking place inside the other person. The kingdom of heaven is within. And that's something that's exceedingly important to remember. And this is why it's really important that we purify our own being, so that when we feel an emotion of a given type, that it is pure and that it is not personally oriented, because you don't know for sure whether you're seeing your sins or you're seeing someone else's sins. That's why purification is really important. Anybody who has ever done any work with psychology knows that this is the principle of projection. Psychologists or psychiatrists work with this all the time. And they do so with purpose. Very often, the psychiatrist will befriend a patient, and the patient will project all of its being on the psychiatrist so that at one moment the psychiatrist is an angel, and the next moment the psychiatrist is a devil. And this is called transference, which is a very special kind of projection. And then the psychiatrist, if it is a good psychiatrist, gradually gives you back your own feelings so that you can own up to them. So you can say, yes, I really am jealous of this person, and it's a real weight to have on me. And you can't say that it is that the psychiatrist is envious of me, the patient. It's that kind of thing. So when you're experiencing that, when you're seeing something and you don't know whether it's in the other person, in yourself, that is much closer to clairvoyance than if you're seeing all kinds of flashy colors. Because all the kinds of flashy colors are only the externality. But when you're seeing the inner meaning, when you're seeing something of motivation that is another person, you're seeing more of the reality. All right. Yes. Same way. In fact, tomorrow morning we're going to look at the horoscope of a blind person who had an inward clairvoyance. It's just that the blind person has an advantage over the sighted person because they are not distracted by physical vision, and they can focus everything on the inner vision. Werner Herzog, who made a lot of very good art films about 20 years ago, also made a film where he went to where there were a lot of deaf-blind people. And a lot of those deaf-blind people talked about their experiences of the world of color and the feelings that they had with regard to it. It was kind of a bizarre film, unless you're studying this sort of thing. That is a very excellent question, and it's in some ways it is an advantage. In fact, this is why often blind people are second-sighted. There are multiple reasons for anything that happens to us. Our lives are much too important to waste on one single reason. And if we're blind, it might be because we were a fool in a past life, but it might also be so that we can turn inward unabatedly and undistractedly and see the inner realities for what they are. So what we're talking about here is exercising controlled receptivity. That is intentionally reaching out and drawing things in or making ourselves open to things. Not passivity, because passivity indicates someone who cannot control the activity at all. And there's a kind of clairvoyance that is an involuntary clairvoyance where people are passive and things just take them over, the feelings of other people. Now, one has to be very careful about to discriminate the difference between life and form. As we said earlier, the form in the desire worlds might appear like hideous monsters, and they might seem like very powerful demonic beings. And we all know the opposite happens, because most people are taken off guard when they get into the inner world, because the most demonic beings appear as harmless little imps. And they say, that couldn't be anything horrible, because they know that we're subject to the illusion of taking things according to the appearances rather than according to the inner reality. We do this all the time. Depending on our psychological state, if we see somebody scowling, or if we see somebody nodding their eyebrows, we think we know what it means. However, the outer facial expression can indicate what's going on inwardly, but any actor can tell you that they can make expression so that outwardly it seems like one thing is happening and they know from within that something very different is happening. That's one of the things of acting. This is why in the mystery schools, one of the reasons why all of the early initiations were acting out myths. And in acting, people learn to be something then attached to the personality as it is now. They could act out something cosmically and live in a very high state. So one has to look beyond the appearance to see whether the person really is angry or whether the person really is pensive. The primary vehicle or form through which color appears to be expressed is called, through which desire or emotion appears to be expressed is color. I'll go over that again because it's really important. Primary vehicle or form through which emotion or desire is expressed is through color. Color, in this instance, is a vehicle just like a smile on a face is a vehicle for what's going on inside. Now, if someone doesn't understand this, or if someone is looking at this very superficially, they're likely to be get carried away by the color. Last night we talked about phenomenologists. Now let's talk about phenomenalists. Phenomenalists revel in all kinds of psychic phenomena, including colors in the desire world, without really knowing what they mean or caring what they mean. A very careful way of stating this is, if someone sees pink in the desire world, one is feeling the emotion that one feels when one perceives the color pink. So what you're seeing a feeling, you're perceiving a feeling, and that feeling is just like or analogous or similar to the feeling that you get when you look at the color pink. We must never forget that we're looking at emotion, feeling, and desire, and we're not looking at color. Color is the vehicle that allows us to focus and put our attention on the feeling. Metaphysically, this means that color, emotion, and feeling are intimately bound up throughout the cosmos, because there are colors on in every world. And those colors evoke the same feeling. So color, feeling, and emotion are tied together even in the world of thought or even in the physical world. We see certain colors in this world and we have reactions to them. Even when an emotion is clearly experienced and identified, even that's not enough. It has to be understood. And it has to be understood within the context of that psychologic that we've been talking about in both series of classes. Because desire and color are so intimately related, we can use the physics of color from the chemical region to get some idea, to use it as an analogy to spring into the desire world. Yes. Depending on the objectivity of their objectivity and evolution of their own desire character, yes. Mm-hmm. As we grow up in the experience of emoting, our emotions become more true to nature, and they're less lurid, and they're less personal and subjective. And when that is the case, we can see the same color. But if we have a lot of personal preference, and we're, you know, have a lot of mawkish feelings and things like that, we're likely to take issue with certain kinds of colors and not feel comfortable with it.
So it's kind of
nice.
Yeah. We do see it differently, but there still is a base. So
yeah.
I sort of separate the
question. Yeah. Okay. In the physics of color, there are three attributes to color. They are hue, saturation, and lightness or darkness, which are expressed in tint or in shade. So they're hue, saturation, and lightness or darkness, which are seen as tint or shade. We'll come to what this means. We're using the words the way they're used in physics now, and we're not using them the way that they are used in common parlance. Each of these attributes relates to a member of the divine trinity. We've been saying all along that the desire world is the reflective projective projection of the human spirit. That is the third attribute of the spirit. And when we say that somebody is highly individuated, we say that person is colorful. We can understand each of the attributes of spirit by looking at a physical world analogy. Very simple analogy. This is a storage battery or something like it, and this relates to the divine spirit, the first attribute of the Trinity. We can't see what's in there, but it is the source of power. But if we take a wire and hook it up to a light bulb, the light bulb is like the life spirit. The invisible power of the Father has become visible light of the life spirit or of the Son. Then if that light passes through a prism, we'll just use a triangular prism, then it gets broken up into its component colors. That prism, which is the completion, it's triangular itself, just like the threefold spirit, is like where the one universal light of truth becomes differentiated into all of the different shades. So the human spirit, which is like the prism and the colors, is reflected into the desire world as the experience of motivation. We said yesterday that the individual, when we have had the experience of being a separative individual, then we have the motivation for that separate individual to move around, and that is again the relationship of the human spirit to the desire world. Now, in physics, a color is described by wavelengths of light. That's all right for physics, but there's probably better ways to look at it. In the desire world, it is the quality or the character or the nature of the color. The basis of color is not disorganized. The desire world is by some called the astral world, because the light is filled with life. The life is just brimming out of it. So it sparkles and it shimmers and it's like the stars. It's very live. And someone's feelings are very live, especially when they're away from the physical body. One is alive with feeling. This is one of the great reliefs of somebody who dies. For a long time, they've been encrusting. And suppose somebody dies at like 100 or 104 or something like that. And more, they've been in a vehicle that is less malleable, and you know their existence is more and more limited. And then to throw off the physical body and to be alive in your feelings, wow, that's really something. To be outside of the body, it's almost too much for some people. If you leave in full waking consciousness, at death you have no choice. You just experience it. You don't have a body to go back to. But if you go out of it volitionally and say, what have I done? Here I always wanted to be outside of my body, and now I'm not so sure, because it's an overwhelming experience, but at the same time, you are really living. It is like coming back to this world. I can see why the early initiates like Plato said that this world is a sarcophagus, this body is a sarcophagus, and this is the world of death. And to come back to this world is to be going to dying. And we've been talking a lot in the other class, another reason why the desire world is sometimes called the astral world is because it is filled with all of the astrological influences. Paracelsus, who was a great seer, found that the desire influences are poured into the desire world through the planets, as though the planets were like vortices in our personal desire bodies. So there is a logic to color that is a color logic. And that color logic, any artist may not be able to put it in words, because very often artists are nonverbal, but they know that there's a logic to color. I think that the anthroposophists do very well with understanding the language of color. They spend many years studying color and how the life of one color affects the life of another color. And they try to do it in such a way that it relates to their emotions. Let's see, where are we here? I don't want to get lost again. So it's an astrologic, a psychologic, and a color logic. And believe it or not, if you're dressing to go out for the night and you color coordinate in one way or another, you're actually preparing yourself for the desire world. Because, you know, like blues and greens clash with each other. Very obvious thing. And you can see that there is a war of color. It's best learned by observation. It's a really good thing. You can go to any good art store and you can get a pack of cards about that big. They're about 4x6. And they have all kinds of hues in a color wheel, and they have all kinds of tints that have the blackness added, and all kinds that have all kinds of shades that have the blackness added, and all kinds of tints that have the whiteness added. And you'd be surprised how something of one hue appears to be a different hue just because of the blackness or whiteness that is added. I remember I borrowed a set of them once and I didn't mark them. And I got them all jumbled up. And then I tried to... I was up until 3 in the morning looking at color swatches and trying to get them so that the hues were right. It was a big experience for me. My eyes, you know, like... My eyes were something else after looking at the colors for a long time. I don't know how to say it in any other way. So what we're talking about with hue are the different colors. Like if you make a color wheel, each of those colors on that color wheel is a different hue. In nature, the purest colors that we see are the colors in the rainbow, which are like the prism. They are diffracted in such a way that there is just light turned into pure color. Everybody's had those crystal things that they hang in their window, and they're fascinating. You spend hours with them, especially if you look into the color light. It's amazing. You can get, if you move very, 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 very slowly, you can see nothing but pure orange, or you can see nothing but pure yellow. And it's a wonderful thing to do. We have a lot of simple things that we can prepare ourselves for the desire world. However, in the desire world, the number of hues is almost infinite. And the gradations are almost infinite. And the only way that you can really tell one from another is to be able to feel the difference. So like any color wheel that we make on this physical world is as nothing. You can even make your own color wheel by, without looking at humanization, but just look at the zodiac and look at the planets going through the zodiac. If you feel what it feels like for me, sometimes my Saturn in Aries is not greatly different than my Sun in Scorpio, because the Sun in Scorpio has that strong, burning, vital nature, and there's the coldness of Scorpio. On the other hand, Saturn has the coldness, and the fiery Aries has its kind of burning quality. And by watching the stars, just take a minute or two every day and look at the ephemeris, and as things change, you're living inside of a kaleidoscope where you can feel all the differences of the day, and you can really be in touch with the universe. Now, in order to understand the attributes, the other two attributes, that is saturation and blackness and whiteness, or a shade and tint, we have to leave a color wheel and go to a color sphere. Now, in the physical plane, it's not possible to see a color sphere. but in your imagination, you can. Imagine a globe, a sphere, and at the equator of that sphere are all the different hues, going all the way around with all of the very fine gradations. That is hue. Saturation is the intensity of color, and saturation relates to the divine spirit. So that if you were in this color sphere, the very center of it would be like a crystal. It would be completely colorless. It would be completely transparent. But as you went out from the center with the radii in the direction of each of the hues, it would become more and more and more saturation of color. There's not a limit. The only limit is the intensity of your desire. If you have an intensity of a specific love, you can put out a yellow that's unending. You can put so much there that you know there you can't stop. You can go as much intensity as you have. You can do that. The light, the whiteness, and the darkness would be like the North Pole and the South Pole. The more white you add to the red, the more it becomes pinkish, until at the North Pole, it's saturated whiteness. And at the South Pole, it would be like a saturated onyx black. Now, it's something you can't see with the physical eyes. You could do a fairly good job if you were really good with working with plastics. You might be able to make a color sphere, but you couldn't appreciate it the way you could by seeing it in your imagination, where you can see the part that is transparent, where you can see through everything. But those are the three qualities of the spirit that relate to the three qualities of... let's take some examples. If you, don't take me as an authority on all of this, I don't want that, but suppose you see somebody that is manifesting a bright, clear red. That's somebody that is moved to action. But if that has a lot of whiteness in so that it becomes a pink, that action is personalized so that there is a loving quality to it, and pink then is the color of affection. But if that action is mixed with blackness, which is associated with selfishness, so that you have a deep, dark, murky red, you have somebody with an ugly kind of anger. So we can see in the physical world, you know what a dirty red looks like. It's not a very pleasant color at all. So it pays, if you have time, to get some color swatches and just look at things and take some time. I've known artists that lay in bed at night and look at color charts. Where some people lay in bed at night and read, they take color charts. And I've known musicians to take scores and to lay in bed at night and hear the music inside of themselves by reading a score. And these are just ordinary people. They're not even trying to be spiritual clairvoyants or spiritual initiates or things like that. They're just doing it for the love of it. And for our love of life, we should be able to do the same thing with our lives just to become better people. There's excellent what's going on outside. Tomorrow, if it's a nice clear day, there are a lot of colorful flowers out there. And so, like the yellow out here, there's more yellow than your eyes can hold. And just look at them and get a feel of it. It's, you know, the spiritual life is supposed to be the same life as everyone else, just lived at a higher level. And our appreciation of color and our experience of the feel of color, we should be unfolding that so that we get it better and better and better. I'm going awfully slow at this, I'm terribly sorry. But I promised myself after this afternoon, no more fast talks. I don't want to be scattered. I don't want to mess things up. Now, there are obviously problems working with this kind of analogy of a color sphere, because it's comprehensive beyond our emotionality. We would have to be adepts to experience the color sphere as a whole, all at the same time. We just can't experience, you know, we can't, if I go to a symphony, I can't hear all of the parts that all the different instruments are playing. It's too much for me. It's way too big. Sometimes the conductors can. There's a famous case. I think it was Stokowski. One of the musicians broke a key on his instrument, and he said, what do I do? And Stokowski thought for a few minutes, and he said, for the rest of this movement, you're not going to need that key anyway. He had the whole symphony in his mind, and he could do that. So it's something worth getting into. Now, we've been speaking about feeling. And the seers of the Rosicrucian order who have set down the Rosicrucian philosophy, which is probably a living and growing thing, all sciences and philosophies are like that. If they're alive, they're getting better all of the time. But the nature of feeling is fundamental to everything else in the desire world. The function of feeling is fundamental to everything else in the desire world. The claim is that we enter the desire world in the middle, always in the central region, which is called the region of feeling. And it's sort of like the center of our color sphere. In street language, what the Rosicrucian order says would be something like saying, unless you feel something, you can't desire. Unless you feel something, you can't emote. Unless there is an object of your desire or an object of your emotions, there can be no emotions. So fundamental to all experience in the desire world is feeling. But that isn't the end of it all. Clearly, we were hinting at this last night, but clearly when we have this kind of experience, there is a subject and there is an object. The subject is the being that is experiencing the object. It feels the object, and then it relates to it emotionally or in terms of desire. So there's a very clear subject-object relationship in the desire world. Now, the funny thing about the Rosicrucian view is that the centralmost of all the feelings that we have is a feeling and something like an antimatter feeling. The most fundamental feeling is the feeling that is aroused, that is basic to all others, is the feeling of interest. But the antimatter feeling is a feeling of indifference, which is like an unfeeling or a non-feeling or something that your relationship as the subject has nothing to do with the object. It's a very curious conception, and there's an awful lot to deal with it. So some clairvoyant researchers claim that when somebody is very feelingful, they have a lot of interest. And the way that shows up is the brightness of the aura. If the desire world is very bright, you will find that this is a person that is interested in this, and is interested in this, and is interested in everything. You wouldn't want to take a walk with Goethe unless you were really wanting to go through a lot of things. You'd probably stop and be interested in this, and be interested in that, be interested in that. You'd have to be willing to keep up with that if you went for a walk with him. in the Rosicrucian philosophy, interest, emotion, and desire are to be cultivated. They're to be cultivated because they are pro-evolutionary. Except in very incorrigible and dangerous situations, indifference is not to be practiced. Because in indifference, the whole function of the desire world is negated. A person is not moved to do anything. And if you don't do anything, there's no experience. And if there's no experience, there's no evolution. So the function of the desire world is to get us to do something. And if we start practicing indifference, it's a very unhealthy thing. But if sometimes, if we have an unhealthy attachment to something, and we can find no other way to break that attachment, in rare cases, it is okay to practice indifference to break up a pathological interest in something that is destroying our entire life. People who practice indifference and practice it regularly make a very difficult life for themselves, or they make a very difficult afterlife for themselves, because the region of feeling, as far as the antimatter quality of indifference is concerned, if a person gets used to being indifferent, after death, when they're living in the desire world, and the only thing that they have to live by are the quality of their desires, and they have no desires, they're like on a desert. They've got nothing. Nothing at all. And in that regard, in the afterlife, the region of indifference, or the indifferent feelings in the region of feeling in the desire world, is called a borderland. And people seem to wait for centuries and centuries, they don't feel anything. Here they're in a, like they're immersed in a world where the whole value of everything is feeling, and they've trained themselves to not feel. Tough situation. I tend to think that this is one of the great errors that science makes. And science and technology are the extremes of the industry of sex and violence, for warfare and things like that, and our analytic science tears everything apart, and scientists make a great mistake by being indifferent, skeptically indifferent. Now, if you are interested in something, and you're interested in a positive way that you care about it, you will be attracted to the truth of that matter much more quickly than if you are indifferent. You still have to prove it out, as you can be as rigorous with love as you can with skepticism and indifference. With love, if you really, if you love somebody, you don't want to give them something that's wrong. If you love something, you give it the best that you have, and science could be based on something like that. And I think that we impede the general progress of humanity as far as understanding the world around us, and as far as the utilization of our understanding of the world around us, by practicing skeptical indifference. Yes? They can't. They don't have anything to relate to the next level. They have to experience the decomposition of their desire body. And if I understand, the composition of their desire body is made of feelings of indifference. And until those feelings of indifference have been neutralized by that horrible feeling of boredom, they have to be with their desire body. That's it. but the spirit knows, and the spirit is suffering because there's nothing for it to do. The people who are bored, you can't, if a person has an indifference and is so mental that they don't try to express in the desire world at all, they're bored, and there's nothing you can do to cure their boredom. But they still suffer the boredom. Yes, and their actions were indifferent, and that's what they experience, okay, until they let go of them.
The other person felt, and they feel what the other person felt.
Not if they were indifferent to the other person. Torturers are indifferent to other people.
So
and they feel...
neutralize that by feeling what the other person feels.
To some extent, yes, but they still feel all of their indifference until they let go of it. And letting go of it is important. It is said, Emanuel Swedenborg said, I believe it was of, who is the Swiss theologian? Very fundamentalist. He had an unusually long time, John Calvin, yes, had an unusually, many times longer than other people, stay in purgatory because he wouldn't admit that he was dead. Because in his fundamentalism, he knew what it was like to be dead, and this wasn't it. And until he let go of it, which was a long time, he suffered. And the same thing is somebody who hangs on believing that the best thing is scientific indifference and won't let go of it because they had their whole life invested in being indifferent. You know, there are scientists that believe that if you have feelings, that's superstition. And that's an incomplete person. But we're getting awfully long here. I don't want to... All right. So if we experience something new, we feel it. And if we take interest in it, we act in one way or another. But if we're indifferent, our relationship to that object dies on the vine. Now, if there is interest, especially if there is keen interest, then the forces that are active in the desire world are set into action. It's not stated in the Rosicrucian philosophy, but in experience it appears to be that way, that the degree of interest determines the degree of attraction or repulsion. If you're really interested in something, you're going to be really attracted to it, or you're going to be really repulsed by it. So that if we have a rabbit and a fox, the self-assertion of the fox wanting the rabbit as its object of desire is an intense motivation of repulsion for both of them. The rabbit wants its life, and it draws its life to itself, and it runs. Yes? Yes, in that regard. But no, the scorpionic nature desires intensely. Tomorrow we're going to be talking about the region of feeling astrologically, and the region of feeling, I'll give you a preview of coming attractions. The region of feeling, which is central to the whole desire world and the desire body was developed in the moon period. And therefore, the feelability in the horoscope is determined by the moon and or planets in Cancer. So the Cancer is the type of individual that is very strongly feeling and sometimes is almost paralyzed by them. The desire, especially if the desire is selfish, that intensity of desiring is Scorpio. But anyone, Virgo, Gerda was a Virgo, and he had emotions strong enough, he developed them on his own, he had emotions strong enough that he started movements of poetry and movements of fashion, the way people dressed all across Europe. When he did the Younger Werther, everybody was buying little blue suede jackets, and all of the intellectuals, they were so swept away by all of that. But we were getting way, way far aside. Yeah. Yes. But we're coming. That's Thursday. Thursday we discuss the repulsion horoscopes in the lower desire world, and Friday we discuss the attraction and the higher desire world, and with real simple examples. All right. Yes, 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 exactly. In spiritual things, balanced extremism is what is called for. Now, this is a way you can look at it, and it's only an analogy. But our desire body is like a force field of emotion and desire. And it's like desire comes radiating out of us, and it comes radiating back in. And it takes the same paths on the outgoing as it does on the ingoing. All right, that's just take that as an analog. In this analog, we are in the core. We are the subject. And the nature of the force that we set loose in the desire world depends on our intent in the expression of desire or in the expression of emotion. So if we put our intent on the indrawing, the outgoing has one effect. But if we put our intent on the outgoing, then the incoming has a different effect. All right, we got it that far. It's real simple. So if what is coming into us, if we put our intent on that and say, I want that, we assert our intention. And when we assert our intention to draw something to us, then the outward flow is repulsive. The perfect example, I'm sure you've all seen it, if you feed a dog and there are other dogs around, that dog will put itself at that bowl and it'll put out repulsive growls to keep the other dogs away. That is a perfect example of asserting itself to its own end to take something to itself, and the result of that is the pushing away of repulsion. The other way it goes, if our intention is on the outward flow, if we sacrifice ourselves and give to others, and lovingly give to others, then the inward flow is attractive. Everybody wants to be around somebody who loves, right? They're popular people. There are people that you're magnetically drawn to. And so these are the very simple workings of the desire world. And I'm saying very simple because we have all the flavors of all the different planets and all the different signs of the zodiac. So there's all kinds of different attractions and repulsions going on. And we never have simple motivations. Once in a while we have simple motivations, but for the most part, we have mixed motivations. We are not, our eye is not single. And because our eye is not single, we have all kinds of mixed motivations. Do I do this or not do this? Do I love this person or do I not? You know, we go and we flutter back and forth in mixed motivation all the time. All right, now we have the basic workings of the desire world. It's all very, very simplified. Tomorrow, we're going to look at the structure of the desire world and of the structure of the desire body, taking these very simple principles and seeing how they work into making a whole world. But that whole world has many, many corridors in it. There are areas that you can get in. People have had some awfully weird emotions and feelings throughout history. And you can get into some really strange kinds of things. just, I won't get scorpionic about it, but there's an awful lot of perversions out there, and they all have desire equivalents, and they're really strange kinds of things. So tomorrow we're going to talk about the desire world and each of the regions of the desire world and how each of those regions is a consequence of how the simplest laws of interest and indifference mix together with attraction and repulsion that are the result of either self-assertion or self-sacrificing love. How they work, and they produce a whole general world in which there are many sub-worlds possible. And so we'll close with the student's prayer. O God, increase our love for Thee so that we may serve Thee better from day to day. Let the words of our mouths and the meditation of our hearts be acceptable in Thy sight. O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer.